Good afternoon. I'm Sharon Leon from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. I'd like to welcome you to the March 23rd Objective History Audiocast. The Objective History is a joint project of the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History to provide students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from NMAH's collections. Our focus for today is the Woolworth's lunch counter from Greensboro, North Carolina, where four young African-American college students sat down on February 1, 1960, and refused to leave until they were served. That sit-in eventually prompted the desegregation of the lunch counter in July 1960. But it also launched a movement of nonviolent direct action protest against segregation across the South. We're joined today by three guests who will answer your questions about the lunch counter, the Woolworth sit-in, and its impact on the civil rights movement. Stephen Lawson is a historian joining us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, where he's professor of American history at Rutgers State University of New Jersey. Professor Lawson is an expert on African-American politics, particularly with regard to voting rights. Since receiving his Ph.D. in 1972 from Columbia University, he's taught and served as department head at the University of South Florida, Tampa, University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and he has been at Rutgers since 1998. Professor Lawson has written numerous books, including Black Ballots, Voting Rights in the South, 1944 to 1969, Running for Freedom, Civil Rights and Black Politics in America since 1941, and Civil Rights Crossroads, Nation, Community, and the Black Freedom Struggle. Second, Faith Davis Ruffins is curator of African American history and culture in the Division of Home and Community Life at NMAH. She has worked as a historian and curator there since 1981. From 1988 to 2000, she was the head of collection of advertising history at the Archive Center. Davis Ruffins is widely published on issues relating to African American history, museums, historic preservation, and public history. She's worked on a number of exhibits at NMAH and has been guest curator for the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, the Ghana Smithsonian Exhibition Project, and the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center. Finally, Bill Yangst is the chair of the Division of Home and Community Life at NMAH. He has primary responsibility for researching and collecting in the area of American social history, household and family life, and domestic furnishings. Yangst works with collections that range from entire houses to furniture to Tupperware. He is the curator who actually collected the Woolworth's lunch counter. And over the last 25 years, he has curated many exhibitions at the Smithsonian. So our focus for today, the Greensboro lunch counter, and our very first question comes from Seattle, and it's a question about preservation, Bill. The person writing this question, I don't actually have a name here, wants to know whether or not there were sort of remnants of the sort of wear and tear of many years of service on the lunch counter when you collected it, or had it already been restored?
Actually, when I first went down to Greensboro and saw the counter in person, I was struck that I had entered a time capsule. The counter was largely, the store was largely unchanged. And the counter, other than a slight modification in the 1970s to expand a portion of the seating on the counter, was largely intact. So this is exactly the way we like to find objects, because we curators function as largely as detectives, and we look to material culture along with pictures and historical narrative and so on as evidence. And what we do is assemble this evidence together to tell stories, to create narratives about history. And it was really in my role as a curator at the National Museum of American History back in 1993 when I was helping the museum document the role of young people in bringing about social, cultural, and political change in America, that I became aware that the Greensboro Woolworth store was closing. And as curators, we all have this list of objects in the back of our mind. That's part of our collections planning here at the museum. Things that we would like to acquire that really serve as a material record of the American past. So the Greensboro store in particular was of interest to me because on February 1st, 1960, it was four young people who really stepped into history that day and helped shape the future of America. And they in turn were shaped by that experience. It was through their incredible courage and sacrifice that sort of launched this tidal wave of change, along with thousands of other supporters across the nation.
Great, Bill. Thanks. I was wondering maybe, Stephen, if you can tell us how, position for us, where the efforts of these young activists fit in the trajectory of the effort to desegregate the South.
Well, they do spark. I mean, I think what is historically important about the Greensboro movement in 1960, the sit-in movement in 1960, is that although they were not the first to take place, there had been several scattered around the country, both in the South and in the Midwest, in 1958 and 1959. So Greensboro was not the first in the modern period. But it was the sit-in effort that sparked hundreds of other sit-in demonstrations throughout the South. And once it did that, what it was successful in doing was to reinvigorate a movement that had already begun back in the late 1940s, 1950s, but had not progressed very far. And what it succeeded in doing was to bring new blood, young blood, particularly of high school and college students who didn't have as much to lose economically as their parents had. It was a new generation of students educated in the period after World War II when the values of democracy and freedom and anti-totalitarianism were taught in the schools during the period in which the United States was fighting the Soviet Union and communism for world domination. And this is that new generation. And what they do is to invigorate the civil rights movement and also create new organizations that will rise to the forefront of the movement, particularly in the hardest areas to crack segregation in the South, generally those areas in the Deep South in which blacks are a majority of the population and which segregation is most rigid. And out of the sit-ins came the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, which really became the shock troops of the civil rights battles that extended beyond merely lunch counters to every aspect of racism, segregation, and the loss of the right to vote in the South.
Very good. Faith, Kristen in Helena, Montana wants to know whether or not nonviolent protest was widespread in the civil rights movement before the sit-ins.
Nonviolence as a formal philosophy and as a practice, a way of protesting was... Not widespread. There were other forms of protest which we could describe as nonviolent, such as silent parades that took place in New York after lynchings and boycotts in which people had signs protesting stores and other services that were unfair. There was, of course, the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 through 1957, in which the people who are protesting by boycotting the buses, by not riding the buses, are not themselves violent. But what we think of or name this new tradition, this new way of protesting, which involved confronting authority directly, but confronting it in a nonviolent manner, was a philosophy and a practice that had come out of the Indian and India's independence movement, led among others by Mahatma Mohandas Gandhi, and was taught in some cases directly by him and by his associates to various people who were engaged in pacifism and other Quakers and other kinds of protest in the United States during the 1940s and later. So it's that, it's out of a relatively new tradition that these this what we know of today as the nonviolent but direct action wing of the civil rights movement emerged.
Stephen, where would these students have become acquainted with this theory and practice of nonviolence?
Well, they could have become acquainted, of course, in high school. They went to black high schools. This high school in Greensboro was segregated, Dudley High School. I'm not sure they learned nonviolence, at least the Greensboro four were not necessarily studying nonviolence. They knew of Dr. King. They knew of Dr. King had spoken in Greensboro, so they knew of him. They were they came out of the NAACP and its youth councils, which were very important in the civil rights movement. If you go and look in 1960, where most of these young people have been associated with, you find that they were members of the NAACP youth councils. And the youth councils of the NAACP were not really teaching nonviolence as a practice, as Faith talked about it. But in earlier, in Nashville, Tennessee, which really becomes the center of youth training in nonviolence under the Reverend Jim Lawson, who had studied nonviolence in India, had been in India and after Gandhi had been killed, but had studied nonviolence from his disciples. James Lawson taught nonviolent workshops in Nashville, and it was the students who studied under him and who then participated about a week and a half after the Greensboro young people had their sit-in. They held a sit-in in Nashville. It was those students like Diane Nash, John Lewis, who now is a congressman from Georgia, it was they who understood the real teachings of nonviolence. Nonviolence is not easy. Nonviolence is a very, very difficult philosophy to embrace. And in fact, I would argue that from 1960 to 1965, a small minority, a pretty small minority of people involved in demonstrations were philosophically committed to nonviolence, which meant that they would exercise it as a matter of principle in every aspect of their lives. Most of the people who use nonviolence, including the people in SNCC, believed in tactical nonviolence, which means that they were willing to follow it in particular demonstrations because they believed it would have a bigger political effect, but they were not philosophically committed to nonviolence. They believed that there were moments where you had to have self-defense. If someone hit you or attacked you, you might, you know, have to respond in kind, but they were willing to put that aside in demonstrations because they believed in the, you know, the greater good of the movement. But so the actual people who believed in, you know, what might call Gandhian nonviolence is very, very small, but they were a committed group.
Just as to add to what Stephen has very ably said, a person whose name we should maybe introduce here is Howard Thurman, the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman, who was a minister and a theologian. And he and his wife had directly studied with Gandhi and influenced a generation of ministers, including Martin Luther King. And later, a generation of ministers who surrounded King, and some of the young people, then young people that Stephen has already mentioned. It's I think, useful to note that although it hasn't been taught much in schools, there were many examples of African Americans defending themselves with weapons upon attack in the South and in other parts of the country. But in a number of cases, these efforts, whole towns in the South could be surrounded, whole neighborhoods could be surrounded, riots could take place in which white people poured in from neighboring areas to quell what they saw as black rebellion. So it's important to communicate the sense that there are many traditions of black people defending themselves, in some cases violently, but in part because these earlier efforts had often ended in even greater violence and not resulted in the complete protection of these communities, that this new younger group of people took on the tactic of tactical nonviolence. I think a great phrase that.
If I could just add that
hadn't worked in the same way.
Along with this escalating activism, one little footnote here. In 1957, Dr. Annie Gist, who was a health education professor at Virginia's Hampton Institute, happened to be home in Greensboro on a summer vacation. And she tried unsuccessfully to swim at a segregated pool in Greensboro. And she happened to be accompanied by Bennett College student. And Azelle Blair Sr., who was the father of one of the four who initiated the Greensboro sit-in, and who was president of the local NAACP chapter and was very active, was there as well. So there is this tie, this sort of among families, among communities, among folks in Greensboro and throughout the South.
That's great, Bill. We have a question here from Jeff in Columbus that I think is probably best directed to you. Jeff wants to know what kinds of research you do to put together an exhibit that would surround the lunch counter. Sort of what kinds of background work do you do to exhibit something like the lunch counter?
Good question. Well, like I said, what we do is we begin with the object and we look for evidence in the object. In the case of the lunch counter, it's not something that really speaks to what it is symbolically known for. It's really an object that played on multiple stages, if you will. And so as a curator, you begin to peel back these layers to uncover its history as a common, you know, luncheonette where people gathered in the South and were part of this sort of system of laws and expectations that created these two separate worlds. It was something that you can look at in terms of Southern business history. But importantly for us, it became this physical focal point of cultural protest. And so that is what we were really interested in. We wanted to talk first and foremost to the people that were involved in the sit-in, the four students, the manager of the store, and other people in the community. We did research with the local newspaper concerning interviews and their coverage, but also they provided an important photographic record of what transpired from February 1st through July and then thereafter. So we do the research, we do the oral histories, we do photographic research, and then what we do is put it together usually in an interpretation that tells a story. There are any number of different ways of interpreting the past. In the case of the lunch counter, we felt that it was really important to put it on exhibition rather quickly after acquiring it. And what we wanted to do was to put it on exhibit on the second floor of the museum within sight of the Star Spangled Banner. And this was in an exhibition, a hallway, if you will, situated for viewing icons. And so it limited our ability to sort of convey the drama and the excitement that was part of this ongoing struggle, the act of the protest, the courage, the sacrifice that took place. But we were able to give it a place of prominence here in the museum to say to our visitors that to our African-American visitors, that your history is here as well. Because curators have the power, and museums certainly have the power, to save or forget a people's culture, the power to shape memory. So these are things that we try to do openly and judiciously and take our work seriously.
Thank you. Faith, as curator for African American history in the Division of Home and Community Life, where would you position the lunch counter in a larger scope of the African American collections of the museum?
Well, it's a very important object in terms of the museum's collections because it is associated with a signal event. So association objects often are very important. And many of the other materials that we have that relate to the civil rights movement are small, I mean literally small. Mm-hmm. So the lunch counter is you know, a big object, and in a museum, big objects attract attention. You know, you can see a big object from down the hallway and you might be drawn to it. So it's an extremely important object in documenting 20th century, mid to late 20th century, and civil rights activity in the United States. We do have other objects that document some of that history, but our collection is perhaps stronger overall in areas of music, particularly jazz, and in photography, and in the fact that we have a number of very early objects that are related to the abolition movement and 19th century American history, which many collections don't have. So it's a very important object, an anchor object, or a national treasure kind of object because of its association with such an important set of events in a larger movement of great importance to the United States, and the fact that it's a physically a commanding object that you can use to anchor a big story.
Stephen, having lived and worked in Greensboro, how do you feel the community there thinks about the history of the sit-ins and the role of this event in the life of the community?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I mean, the community, because really we should say communities.
Right.
There's not just one white community, and there's not just one black community, but they do take a pride in the fact that this happened in Greensboro, and that's one of the significant events of the civil rights movement. Everybody, I'm pretty sure everybody who lives in Greensboro knows about it. But it's their interpretations that are interesting. At the time, what they congratulated themselves, people living in Greensboro, they congratulated themselves on how well they had handled the whole issue. And you know, compared to some other places, they did handle it rather well. There was, you know, almost no violence. This is now 1960. There was almost no violence to speak of, and I think someone mentioned earlier that by July the Woolworths and some other places were desegregated, and they put a premium on what they say civilities, civility, that what they have always tried to do is to use reason, to use courtesy, to work these problems out with a minimum of confrontation, a minimum of conflict. And the problem with that is that they continue to be surprised when their problems emerge in Greensboro. And there are problems that can only emerge not through civility, not just by talking about it courteously, but they emerge through confrontation. And after the 1960 sit-in, that hardly solved all the problems. In fact, 2 years later, there were much more widespread protests led by some of the same people in North Carolina, A&T. A new person on the scene was Jesse Jackson, and he was quite active in marches and protests through downtown to try to integrate not just lunch counters or restaurants, but movie theaters and other public places. And newspapers were concerned. They thought that this was not civil. This was not civility, and they complained about it. But they worked it out, and they were happy about it. And I think they look back on it fondly. They think that they worked it out, with a minimum of protest, and they commemorate the four people who participated, and only three who were alive. If you went to the Greensboro Woolworths, I assume it's still there in front, probably, about 12, 13 years ago, they put up a little plaque to commemorate the four, and they have footprints or handprints, I can't remember now, one or the other, probably handprints of the four protesters, and they, so they accept it, but that doesn't mean that Greensboro is without the deeper problems that existed in 1960 and have not been solved, and that's the economic problems and problems of political power.
Very good. Faith, we've got an interesting question from David in Reno here. He wants to know if there were other Americans who were not allowed to sit at the lunch counters besides African Americans.
That's a very interesting question. It speaks to the larger regulations of segregation. Segregation segregated everyone in the United States, not just black people, so that in areas that in which the largest minority groups were Mexican American or Chinese American or Japanese American or American Indian, Native American, these areas often had segregation by law or by practice as well. Not at times there were areas that were not that did not have laws, segregation laws, but people practiced the custom of segregation throughout the nation in many places. Some people, some groups of people, as various people immigrated, migrated around the United States, caused what might be called category problems because they didn't fit the notions of segregation. So that when you have communities that are unexpected, such as the Mississippi Chinese. There's a significant community of Chinese Americans who got to Mississippi in the 19th century associated with building the railroads and have remained in Mississippi more or less to the present. Well, when segregation laws are erected, there becomes the question of how are we going to classify this group of Chinese people? Ultimately, they get classified essentially as colored, but they end up having their own separate schools, for example. So there are local difficulties that emerge, but the larger picture that people were segregated based on notions of race pretty much is present throughout the country, but exactly who is being segregated at what moment might change based on the demographics of that place. It is kind of interesting to note, though, that there are funny, shall we say, in the ironic sense, occasions that would occur when someone who was of high rank like a prince of an Indian princedom comes to the United States. Well, is he going to get classified based on his color or his rank as a member of royalty? And there would be discussions about this in newspapers, and at some places he would be received or not. There are fascinating examples that show how people were trying to parse out these very complex notions of the world and fit very complex people in the world and fit them into this very rigid system of segregation that the United States really is the only country in the Americas to ever pass these very formal laws and notions of race, and then have to have a very violent set of movements to overthrow them. It's really kind of an interesting aspect of U.S. history when you compare it to other places in the Americas that also had a prior history of slavery.
Let me add something. The last point that Faith made about perhaps these Indian royalty, I mean, there were very real problems in 1960 of African diplomats coming to the United Nations and then going to Washington, D.C. They'd have to drive from New York City to Washington, D.C. through Maryland, and there were many facilities on that trip that would not serve colored people, and that would include the diplomats, and that would create an international furor, and the State Department had to get involved and did make efforts at least to try to desegregate some of those facilities. In fact, the whole question of the role of African Americans in this country really took on an international perspective, particularly as the non-white nations in Africa and Asia threw off colonial rule in the 1950s and 60s and then came to this country as part of the United Nations and whatever, that bad race relations in this country was not good for American foreign policy during the Cold War, when the United States was trying to convince these non-aligned nations, most of whom were not white, that the United States was really the democratic power and the Soviet Union was the evil power. How do you uphold the United States as democratic when 10-20% of its population does not have the rights of the other 80% of the population? So it was a very significant foreign policy issue that actually helped promote civil rights and voting rights during this period.
Interesting. We've got another question that's based on another axis of identity here. We've got Christina in Syracuse wants to know, she's noticed that the first four people to participate in the sit-in were boys, whether there were young women involved in this movement, Stephen.
Yeah, there were. There were, of course, women involved in Nashville, even in Diane Nash, who was going to school in Nashville, was really one of the key figures in that. And there were many other women. But even in Greensboro, although the first people were young men, there was a women's college, a black women's college called Bennett in Greensboro. It's a pretty small college, but the young women of Bennett were very active in the sit-in movement, and the president of Bennett was a woman who supported their activities in the movement. And then, you know, women from North Carolina A&T were also involved. I mean, you're raising a larger question. That's a very interesting question, and I'm sure most of the students who are listening to this and reading their books generally find that the heroes of the civil rights movement that appear in the books are men. But they might know Rosa Parks, for instance, which tends to be the exception to the rule of men leading the movement. But in almost every case, in every instance, particularly, of course, on the local level where the action occurred, the greater presence in these demonstrations and in the churches which supported the demonstrations was the presence of women. I mean, women were absolutely key in performing the tasks that were not necessarily visible. They were not the people who were the spokespersons. Of course, they were not the ministers. But they were key within the churches in organizing whatever the activities that took place for the movement. And they were a very, very powerful force. And of course, there are very impressive women who I think are now beginning to be taught alongside Rosa Parks, Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi, who is a very, very powerful figure in terms of securing African-American voting rights. A woman
Septima
who was not,
Clark from
Septima Clark,
South Carolina.
South Carolina. I mean, the whole host. We can you know, fill the next 20 minutes naming these women. And but the point is that women did most of the organizing, and women were full participants in the movement. But given the, you know, the gender customs of that period, given the social hierarchies and gender hierarchies of that period, and given the fact that ministers were very important in the movement, men are the most visible, but women are the key. And in fact, one historian has recently written a book about Durham, North Carolina, which is an hour away from Greensboro, in which she argues that the civil rights movement was a woman's movement its foundation. So, yes, women were very important in Greensboro. Black women came from Bennett. There were some white women that came from the North Carolina College of Women, which was also in Greensboro. That now is the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, where I taught.
Just to add the name of another woman who their good biography about now, Ella Baker.
Ella Baker, yeah.
Who was originally, well, who worked with Martin Luther King in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, but she really can be seen as the godmother, so to speak, of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, because when the students come together after these various sit-ins in Greensboro and Nashville, she is they ask her for her advice. She attends that first conference, and she's the person who is credited with suggesting to them that they form their own movement, that they not join just with the SCLC and follow the lead of the ministers, but that they take their youthful energy and differences of opinion and form a distinctive organization that will be able to reflect their point of view. I think that she is a really good example of someone who was a strong activist woman her entire life, and she started her activism in the North in New York City, but understood the complexities of gender politics of that time, and there helped encourage people who were younger, who could go their own way, so to speak, and that she's a very interesting person to look at as a woman who was activist, but also, you know, limited to some degree by the gender expectations of her time, yet helping to create or give a voice to this new kind of youthful energy that SNCC and CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, really represent.
Let me just add one more name, because it's significant, and one that's even less known, I think, than Ella Baker or Fannie Lou Hamer, and that's Ruby Doris Smith Robinson,
right,
who was one of the students in Georgia who became involved in sit-ins and freedom rides, and she became the first executive secretary of SNCC. People know Stokely Carmichael, of course, but they don't know Ruby Doris Smith. Unfortunately, she died in her mid-20s from cancer.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible situation. So there are many, many, many of these folks who are out there.
Bill, I wanted to ask you, I know that there was a gathering when the lunch counter was unveiled at the museum, and if you could tell us a little bit about the reflections of the surviving activists on the event of having the lunch counter be a part of the museum's collections.
Sure. To mark the 35th anniversary of the sit-in back in 1995, we invited the three surviving men to come to the museum. And we also welcome Diane Nash to come and offer her reflections about the civil rights movement. And during this roundtable discussion, in which they offered their memories of what it was like to sit in and to be a part of this, There was this sort of wonderful dynamic that evolved between the audience and these men who now, these are people who remain sort of committed to social justice throughout their lives. McNeil retired as a major general in the Air Force. And just as a footnote here, these guys, one of them wore their ROTC uniform that day when they initiated the sit-in. And an important thing to remember is this sort of dynamic between protest and patriotism, and that how many people view protest and dissent as a threat to the American political system. But the struggle to improve the American way of life through this kind of reform has been a long-standing part of our history, really, since the time of the Revolution. David Richman passed on in 1990, so he wasn't with us, but Blair, who changed his name to Jabril Kazan, was here, and he reflected on his work with disabled Americans. And McCain, who is a retired educator, continues to be very active on civil boards in North Carolina and to work with groups locally. All were very supportive of the fact that this small portion of this very large lunch counter, which initially seated, I believe it was 69 people, we ended up with four seats and four stools and an 8-foot section of the counter. They were very, I think, proud to see this object and their stories here on the national stage, because this event in Greensboro in 1960 started out as a local story. It quickly spread to become a regional story, and then through the role of television and the media, it became a national story. And so for them, I think they felt, along with Diane Nash and other people who were involved in sit-ins across the nation, I think felt rewarded to see that their history is now a part of the Smithsonian and sort of as one of the places that keep our national memory, that this object will be maintained in perpetuity and properly cared for and preserved.
Very good. Since this is our final audio cast on the lunch counter, I want to take a second to give each of you some time to perhaps provide us with any closing thoughts, something that you think that is important about the lunch counter and the history of desegregation and the civil rights movement that perhaps we haven't talked about over the last 4 weeks, or we haven't had a question about. If there's anything that stands out in your mind in that regard. Can I be so bold as to ask to start with you, Stephen?
Yeah, okay, that'd be great. I want to emphasize one thing that I think is often confused about what the civil rights movement, you know, was all about. And I think most people tend to think of it as being focused on integration, and that was the key component, that somehow black people were pushing to sit in a lunch counter with white people or want to sit next to them in their classrooms or in a movie theater or so forth. And that was really the key. But I think that really misses the point, and I think it misses the point with the lunch counter. It was not that black folks wanted to be like white folks and they thought that sitting next to them somehow whiteness would rub off on them and they would become more like white people, more assimilated into the larger white culture. What they were looking for, I think what the civil rights movement was really all about, was about power, access, and dignity. The dignity to function as a first-class citizen. And Franklin McCain, I think, said it very well. McCain, of course, was one of the original Greensboro Four, and in an interview that he gave probably about 20 years after the sit-ins, he said what I think the movement meant to most people, and that's how it transformed him. It transformed him and gave him the kind of dignity that America had refused to give to black people for some several hundred years. And he says, and I quote him, "It seems like a lot of feelings of guilt or what have you suddenly left me," when he sat in at the lunch counter, "and I felt as though I had gained my manhood, so to speak, and not only gained it, but had developed quite a lot of respect for it." And I think that sums up for so many people who participated in the movement what it was really about. I mean, of course they wanted integration, but what they wanted was dignity, respect, full citizenship, and quite a number of people did gain it, like Franklin McCain.
Very good. Faith, how about you? Some quick closing thoughts?
Quick closing thoughts. Two comments. Although the lunch counter is an event that speaks to issues of commerce, role as consumer, being able to be a consumer, light with other consumers, and with dignity that Stephen, I think, so eloquently quoted Franklin McCain as saying. At the same time, I think it's important to note that one of the significant outcomes of the civil rights movement, which legislatively resulted in the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, is that people across the country, not just black people in the South, but populations across the country, Mexican Americans in Texas and in California, Native Americans in many parts of the West, got the chance to really vote, to exercise that most important citizenship right. And the voting, being able to register to vote, being able to actually vote, and then ultimately being able to run candidates, has significantly changed the makeup of the United States Congress over time. And today, there are any number of people in the House of Representatives, dozens in the House of Representatives, and even a few in the Senate over time who have benefited significantly by the composition of these bodies has changed significantly. And if we look at state legislatures and city governments and city councils, we see a tremendous change across the United States between in the 40-plus years since these events occurred, almost close to 50 years since these events occurred, that the tremendous change in representation for people who had been effectively denied their civil rights is extraordinarily profound. And therefore, I want to reinforce part of what Stephen said, was that dignity was really important, not the sense that somehow being closer to white people would make you feel better, but that dignity and then the ability to impact the government and the representation, to actually be represented, and then have your representatives vote in complex, not simple ways, your interest, just like other Americans had all along, is an enormous outcome of the civil rights movement.
Excellent point. Excellent.
The only other thing that I would say is to reinforce the notion that Frederick Douglass said, you know, there is no change without struggle. That one of the lessons that we need to take from the civil rights movement of the mid-60s, part of the 20th century, is that if people want to make changes in the American system, they have to organize and do this, that activism is very crucial, because things don't change just because people, you know, sort of, you know, they sit at home and think that they might. You have to go out and do something. The modern civil rights movement is about activism, and we need to take that lesson of activism throughout our understanding of the American experience.
Great. A closing word, Bill?
just add to that quickly, Frederick Douglass in 1857 said power concedes nothing without a demand. It
yes.
never did, and it never will. And just one comment directed to our students. Always remember that in whether you're studying the civil rights movement or other topics in American history, you're frequently going to learn about the actions of well-known figures, men such as Martin Luther King and events. But history is really the exciting part of history for me is discovering stories about how ordinary people, much like ourselves, shape and are shaped by history. So I would encourage you to talk to friends, talk to family members, parents, grandparents, and discover their roles in how they participated in big events in American history, whether the Civil Rights Movement, World War II, the Vietnam War, or other events within your own community.
Very good. I want to thank you so much, Bill Yankst, Faith Davis Ruffins, and Stephen Lawson, for spending your time with us to talk about the lunch counter. And I hope that our listeners will join us again next week, March 30th, at 10 minutes after 9 Eastern Time, to talk about the Cesar Chavez family short-handled hoe. We'll be joined by curator Peter Leopold and Yale historian Stephen Peaty. So hopefully you'll listen then. Thank you for joining us in exploring the object of history.